was headed, but I hurried behind it with their cries in the air. Then his eyes fell on me, and he turned quiet. The rest of the way, he watched me come along behind, lagging way back. They hung him from an oak tree on an empty stretch along Ashley Road. Nobody was there but the four guards, the horse, and me. All I could do was squat far off in the palmetto scrub and watch. Then Mark stepped quiet onto the high bench and didn't move when they tugged the noose over his head. He went like he shouted to the others, like a man. Up till they kicked the bench out from under his legs, he stared at the palm leaves where I hid. I looked away when he dropped. I kept my eyes on the ground, listening to the gasps that drifted from the tree. All round, the hermit crabs skittered, looking at me with their tiny, stupid eyes, sliding in and out of holes in the black dirt. When I looked again, then Mark was swaying on the limb with the hanging moss. They took him down, put him in the wood coffin, and nailed the lid. After the wagon disappeared down the road, I eased out from my hiding place and walked to the tree. It was almost peaceful under there in the shade, like nothing had happened. Just the scuff marks in the dust where the bench had fallen over. There was a potter's field nearby. I knew they'd bury him there and nobody would know where he was laid. The edict from the judges said we couldn't cry or say his name or do anything to mark him. But I took a little piece of red thread from my neck pouch and tied it round one of the twigs on a low dipping branch to mark the spot. Then I cried my tears and said his name. Part 5, November 1826 to November 1829. Handful. It was long about November when Goodness caught a chest cough, and I headed to the stable with some whorehound and brown sugar for his throat, thinking it's another dull luster day in the world. One more stitch in the cloth. Up in the house, Mrs. and Nina were bickering. One minute it's the way Mrs. treats us slaves, next it's Nina refusing to go back to society. Without Sarah here to separate them, they kept a fight going all day. Phoebe was in the kitchen house, cooking a stew meat, getting more suggestions from Aunt Sister than she needed. Minta was hiding out someplace, probably the laundry house, and Sawby, if I had to guess, was in the cellar, smoking Master Grimke's pipe. Now that the liquor was gone, I smelled pipe smoke all the time. I slowed down by the vegetable garden to see if Goodis planted it for the winter. It was nothing but dirt clods. The ornament garden was in a shamble, too. The rose vines choking the oleander and the myrtle spurting in 20 wrong directions. Mrs. said Goodis gave Shiftless a bad name, but the man wasn't lazy. He was sick to the back teeth of forcing himself to care about her squashes and flowers. While I was studying the dirt and worrying about him, I got the feeling somebody was watching me. I looked first at Mrs.'s window, but it was empty. The stable door was open, but Goodis had his back to me, rubbing down the horse. Then from the edge of my eye, I saw two figures at the back gate. They didn't move when I looked their way, just stood there in the sharp light, an old slave woman and a slave girl. What'd they want? There was always a slave ready to sell you something, but I'd never seen one come peddling to the back gate. I hated to shoo them off. The old woman was bent and frail-looking. The girl was holding her by the arm. I walked back there, stepping with my cane, my fingers around the rabbit head, feeling how it was smooth to the grain from all the years of holding. The woman and the girl didn't take their eyes off me. Coming closer, I noticed their headscarves were the same washed-out red. The woman had yellow-brown skin. All of a sudden, her eyes flared wide, and her chin started to shake. She said, "Handful." I came to a stop, letting the sound flutter through the air and settle over me. Then I dropped the cane and broke into a run, the closest I could get to one. Seeing me come, the old woman sank to the ground. I didn't have a key for the gate, just flew over it like crossing the sky. Kneeling down, I scooped her in my arms. I must have been shouting, because Goodis came running, then Minta, Phoebe, Aunt Sister, and Sobby. I remember them peering over the gate at us. I remember the strange girl saying, "Is you handful?" And me on the ground rocking the woman like a newborn. "Sweet Lord Jesus," Aunt Sister said. "It's Charlotte." Goodis carried Mama to the cellar room and laid her on the bed. Everybody crowded in and stared at her like she was a specter. We were deer in the woods, froze to stillness, afraid to move. I felt hot, the breath gone from me. Mama's lids rolled back, and I saw the white skins of her eyes had started to yellow like the rest of her. She looked thin as thread. Her face had turned to wrinkles, and her hair had gone salt white. She'd disappeared 14 years ago, but she'd aged 30. The girl hunkered next to her on the bed, with her eyes darting face to face, her skin dark as char. She was big-boned, big-handed, big-footed, with a forehead like the full moon. She looked just like her daddy. Denmark's girl. I told Minta, "Get a wet rag." While I rubbed Mama's face, she started to groan and twist her neck. Sobby hauled off running to fetch Mrs. and Nina, and by the time they showed up, Mama's eyes were starting to open to the right place. The smell of unwashed bodies hung round the bed, making Mrs. draw back and cover her nose. "Charlotte," she said, standing back a ways. "Is that you? I never thought we would see you again. Where on earth have you been?" Mama opened her mouth trying to speak, but her words scratched in the air without much sense. "We're glad you're back, Charlotte," Nina said. Mama blinked at her like she didn't have the first inkling who was saying it. Nina must have been 6 or 7 when Mama disappeared. "Is she in her right mind?" Mrs. asked. Aunt Sister set her hands on her hips. "She's wore out. What she needs is food and a good long rest." Then she sent Phoebe for the stew broth. Mrs. studied the girl. "Who's this?" Of course, that's what everybody wanted to know. The girl drew up straight and gave Mrs. a look that could cut paper. "She's my sister," I said. The room was silent. "Yo, sister," said Mrs. "As I live and breathe, what am I supposed to do with her? I can barely keep the rest of you fed." Nina tugged her mother toward the door. "Charlotte needs rest. Let them see to her." When the door closed behind them, Mama looked up at me with her old smile. She had a big, ugly hole where her two front teeth used to be. She said, "Handful, look at you. Just look at you, my girl, all grown." "I'm 33 now, Mama." "All that time?" Her eyes watered up, the first tears I'd ever seen her shed in my life. I eased down on the bed beside her and put my face to hers. She said low against my ear, "What happened to your leg?" "I took a bad fall," I whispered. Sobby sent everybody to do their chores while I fed Mama spoonfuls of broth and the girl gulped her straight from the bowl. They slept side by side through the afternoon. Time to time, Aunt Sister stuck her head in the dough and said, "Y'all all right?" She brought shortbread, castor oil boiled in milk, and blankets for a floor pallet that I reckoned would be my bed for the night. She helped me ease off their shoes without waking them. And when she saw their feet festered over with sores, she left soap and a bucket of water by the door. The girl roused once and asked for the chamber pot. I let her out to the privy and waited, watching the leaves on the oak tree drop the soft way they floated down. Mama's here. The wonder of it hadn't broken through to me yet. The need to go down on my knees. I couldn't stop feeling the shock of what she looked like, and I was worried what Mrs. might do. She looked at them like two bloodsuckers she wanted to thump off her skin. When the girl came out of the privy barefoot, I said, "We need to wash your feet." She looked down at them with her mouth parted and the pink tip of her tongue poking out. She couldn't be but 13. My sister. I sat her down on the three-legged stool in the yard in the last warm spot from the sun. I brought the bucket and soap outside and stuck her feet in the water to soak. I said, "How many days did you and Mama walk to get here?" She had barely spoken since this morning at the gate, and now the backwash of words rushed from her lips and wouldn't stop. "I ain't sure. 3 weeks? Could be more. We come all the way from Beaufort, Master Wilcox's place. We travel by night, use the footpaths the traders take, and stay to the creeks. In the daytime, we hide in the fields and ditches. This the fifth time we run, so we learn which way to go. Mama, she rubbed pepper and onion peel on our shoes and legs to muddle the dogs. She say this time we ain't going back. We gonna die trying." "Wait now, you and Mama ran off 4 times before this and got caught every time?" She nodded and looked off at the clouds. She said, "One time we get to the Cumberhee River, another time to the Edisto." I lifted her feet from the bucket one at a time and rubbed them with soap while she talked. And that was something she liked to do, talk. "We carry parched corn and dried yams with us, but that run out, so we eat poke leaves and berries, whatever we find. When Mama get where she can't go no more, I'd put on my back and carry her. I'd go a ways, then rest and carry her some more. She said, if something happened to me, keep on till you find handful." The things she told me, how they drank from puddles and licked drops off sassafras leaves, how they climbed trees in the swamp and tied themselves to the limbs and slept, how they wandered lost under the moon and stars. She said one time a buckra came by in a wagon and didn't see them laying right beside him in a ditch. Came to find out she spoke Gullah, the language the slaves used on the islands. She picked it up natural from the plantation women. If she saw a bird, she'd say, "There's a beady." A turtle was a cuda, a white man a buckra. I dried her feet good in my lap. "You didn't tell me your name." "The man who worked us in the rice fields called me Jenny. Mama said that ain't no name. She said our people used to fly like blackbirds. The day I was born, she looked at the sky, and that's what she called me. Sky." The girl didn't look like her name. She was like the trunk of a tree, like a rock in a field you plow around, but I was glad Mama had given it to her. I heard Goodis coughing in the stable and a horse whinny. When I stood, she peered up at me and said, "When we was lost, she tell me the story about the blackbirds I don't know how many times." I smiled at her. She used to tell me that story too. My sister wasn't much to look at, and to hear her talk, you'd think she was too simple to learn. But I felt the toughness of Mama inside her from the start. I came awake that night on the floor pallet, and Mama was standing in the middle of the room with her back to me, not moving, gazing at the high-up window. The darkness was tucked round her, but a kerchief had slipped off and her hair was shining like fresh, polished silver. Over on the mattress, Sky was snoring loud and peaceful. Hearing me stir, Mama turned round and spread open her arms to me. Without making a sound, I got up and went to her. I walked right into her arms. That's when she came home to me. The next time I woke, early light had settled and Mama was sitting up in bed, looking at her story quilt. She'd been sleeping under it all night and didn't know it. I went over and patted her arm. I sewed it all together. The last time she'd seen the quilt, it was a jumbled pile of squares. Some of the color had died out from them, but a story was all there, put together in one piece. "You got every square in the right place," she said. "I don't know how you did that. I went by the order of what happened to you is all." When Phoebe and Aunt Sister brought breakfast, Mama was still hunched over the quilt, studying every stitch. She touched the figure on the last square, the one I knew to be Denmark. It pained me to think I might have to tell her what happened to him. The air in the room had turned frigid during the night, so I got bath water from the laundry house, where Phoebe kept it good and scalding. Skye went over in the corner and washed her thick body while I undid Mama's dress buttons. "We gonna burn this dress," I said, and Mama laughed the best sound. The pouch I'd made for her hung shriveled from her neck with a new strap cut from a piece of hide. She pulled it over her head and handed it to me. "Ain't much left in it now." When I opened it, a moldering smell drifted out. Digging my finger inside, I felt old leaves ground to powder. Mama sat low on the stool while I pulled her arms out of the dress sleeves and let the top drop to her waist, showing the grooves between her ribs and her breasts shrunk like the neck pouch. I dipped a rag in the basin, and when I stepped round to wash her back, she stiffed up. She had whip scars gnarled like tree roots from the top of her back down to her waist. On her right shoulder, she'd been branded with the letter W. It took me a minute before I could touch all that aching sadness. When I finally set her feet in the basin, I asked, "What happened to your teeth?" "They fell out one day," she said. Skye made a sound like, "Huh." She said, "More like they got knocked out." "You don't need to be talking. You tell too many tales," Mama told her. The truth was, Skye would tell more tales than Mama ever knew. Before the week was out, she'd tell me how Mama set loose mischief on the plantation every chance he got. The more they whipped Mama, the more holes she'd cut in the rye sacks. She broke things, stole things, hid things. Buried the threshing sickles in the woods, chopped down fences, one time set fire to the overseer's privy house. Over in the corner, Skye wouldn't let go of the story of Mama's teeth. "It happened the second time we run. The overseer say if she do it again, she'd be easy to spot with her teeth gone. He took a hammer." "Hush up," Mama cried. I squatted down and stared her in the eyes. "Don't you spare me. I've seen my share. I know what the world is."
Sarah. Israel came to call on me wearing a short, freshly grown Quaker beard. We were seated side by side on the divan in the Mott's parlor, and he stroked the whiskers constantly as he talked about the cost of wholesale wool and the marvels of the weather. The beard was thick as velvet brush fringe and peppered with gray. He looked handsomer, sager, like a new incarnation of himself. When I'd returned to Philadelphia after my disastrous attempt to resume life in Charleston, I'd rented a room in the home of Lucretia Mott, determined to make some kind of life for myself, and I suppose I'd done that. Twice weekly, I traveled to Green Hill to tutor Becky, though my old foe, Catherine, had recently informed me that my little protege would be going away to school next year, and my tutoring would end at the first of the summer. If I was to stay useful, I would have to seek out another Quaker family in need of a teacher. But as yet, I hadn't made the effort. Catherine was kinder to me now, though she still drew herself up tight as a bud when she saw Israel smile at me at meeting, something he never failed to do. Nor did he fail in his visits to me, coming twice each month to call on me in Lamotte's parlor. I looked at him now and wondered how we'd gotten ourselves stranded on this endless plateau of friendship. One heard all sorts of rumors about it. That Israel's two eldest sons opposed his remarriage, not on general principle, mind you, but specifically to me. That he'd promised Rebecca on her deathbed he would love no one but her. That some of the elders had counseled him against taking a wife for reasons that ranged from his unreadiness to my unprovenness. I was not, after all, a birthright Quaker. In Charleston, it was being born into the planter class that mattered. Here, it was the Quakers. Some things were the same everywhere. "You're the most patient of women," Israel had told me once. It didn't strike me as much of a virtue. Today, except for the newness of his beard, Israel's visit gradually began to seem like all the rest. I twiddled with my napkin as he talked about merino sheep farms and wool dyes. There was the clink of teacups when the silence came, Children's voices overheard mingled with racing footsteps on creaking floors. And then, abruptly, without preface, he announced, "My son Israel is getting married." The way he said it, quiet and apologetic, embarrassed me. Israel?